Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my first time in the Netherlands. I've been learning a bunch of things. I came here a few days early so that I could adjust to jet lag. And one of the things that I've learned is that spending Saturday in Amsterdam makes the jet lag worse, not better. I was up early working on my presentation, and I drank a pot of coffee, and I've learned that European coffee is stronger than Canadian coffee. And I bravely said last night that I would walk to the venue this morning. And Peter says to me, "Oh yeah, there's no problem. You go out the hotel and you see the building." So I'm out there this morning. Must have had my wrong glasses. All I see is fog. So I'm jet lagged, wired on caffeine, wandering around in a fog, and my presentation came to me in a dream. So, and what really is disturbing is that people won't notice the difference. I'm drawing on a lot of the themes from Graham and Colin. I was giving a talk in Colorado last August, and Peter sent me an insistent email. We need to have, if you won't send us a paper or an abstract, you have to at least send us a title, something to put in the program. And because I was at this conference in Colorado, the thing that was on my mind was the Meta University. And I haven't thought about it since, but it was on my mind then. And this presentation is drawing from that, and it's going to pick up from that presentation. One of the things, and Graham talked about this, and Colin a little bit as well, we have an environment right now in both open source learning management and proprietary learning management where, from the point of view of the students, they pick this institution or that institution or that institution, and that's where they are focused. And the learning communities are all based in this institution. All the resources are based in this institution. It is what sometimes people call the silo model. But what we are moving toward, and I'm quite certain that we are moving toward this, this is not simply a recommendation, it's also a bit of a prediction, is something from the point of view of the student where you don't have this institution, but they all kind of merge into one sort of thing, a meta-university. And they access learning basically from their personal learning environment, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. And Colin, you talked a bit about the certification from the different organizations, and it'll work very much like that, where you're taking some material or using some material here, and eventually you get enough together and somebody gives you a piece of paper and you go, "Oh, that's nice, thank you." And then you go out and get a job. So this talk is some discussion of the architecture of that meta-university. And the reason why this talk is important for this conference is because as you work on open source systems and designs, what this talk will do is give you targets to aim for, what position in the network your application will be, what your application will need to do in terms of communication and things like that in order to work with the rest of the network. Now, I press a button, but what button? Oh, the mouse right in front of me. So it's like this, I can't help feeling the mouse will affect this computer, and I know it won't. Intellectually, I know it won't, but there's something in the back of my mind that says, "Don't do it, you'll stop your recording." But as it turns out, it works fine. Cognition rules over emotion. Right on. Just kidding. Michael Feldstein last August wrote, we need a system that is optimized towards slotting in new pieces as they become available, not as an afterthought or an add-on, but as a fundamental characteristic of the system. What you need to be thinking when you are thinking of learning networks and the meta-university e-learning 2.0 is not a big application that somebody will build, but a whole bunch of little applications that are fundamentally structured to talk to each other, and we'll just add other little applications as we invent them. That's the picture. I know a lot of you work with things like learning management systems, learning content management systems. If you took your learning content management system or your learning management system and you threw it up against the wall, imagine it shattering into a whole bunch of pieces. Good timing. A whole bunch of pieces, that's what you get. Now the whole project is to make all of those pieces talk to each other, because they're not all in one system anymore. Oops, wrong way. What we get when we do that is learning as a network phenomenon, learning networks. Their project is my project. You say, we're working on learning networks. My project is learning networks. Think of it now as a web of user-generated content, social networks, networks of interaction, resources being flung all over the places, being grabbed, mixed together, repurposed, flung out there again, and at the center of it all, the personal learning center. You've seen this diagram, you've seen it over and over and over again, you are sick of it, but the future VLE at the center is the student point of view. The application on the screen, the desktop, as Graham said, it is in the control of and in the hands of the student. It might be an application on the computer, it might be a service available from a website, maybe they have their own server, whatever. But the main point here is, from that application, they are connecting to resources distributed across the web. Now, I'm not going to linger, well, at all, really, on the design of the future VLE itself. People like Scott Wilson and others are working on that, and they, in fact, are in just a few days, are going to try to develop that out in more detail. What I am interested in is the network that a future VLE finds itself in, and that's what I'm after. I'm after the networks part of learning networks. Well, when I was in Colorado, Charles Vest gave a talk. He gave a talk just before mine, in fact. He talked about, well, the successes of the American university system, so I adapted it. And he said there are three major attributes of the U.S. university system. And it occurred to me that these were three major attributes of successful networks. And these are the things, Colin, you should be testing for. So I'm a lot less patient with empirical tests. Go out and sample a dozen students, see what they said, because I have less faith in the cause-effect relation between you try an experimental thing, you get an outcome, because I view this as a complex system. It's like trying to experiment with the weather. But if you want to measure for things, these are the things to measure for. Diversity. We talked about ants, and the talk about ants was relevant. I've trained ants, actually. I really have. I have it on video. If you look up on Google, it says Steve's Ant, A-N-T-X, Steve Antics, Steve's Ant, anyhow, I have a famous ant video. But the main point about ants, and you sort of touched on this, Colin, but I want to draw this out because it's really important. Ant, nobody tells an ant what to do. Trust me, as an experienced ant trainer, the way it works is that each ant acts autonomously, and they're all up to their own thing. And that's the diversity thing. The diversity comes when the individuals in the network work autonomously and make their own decisions for themselves. But not only do they make their decisions autonomously, their decisions impact on each other. So they're interwoven, they're connected, they're joined in some way. And then finally, for this to work at all, and this is the point of our conference, the network has to be open. If you put barriers in the pathways between people trying to do what they want, that breaks the network. And that's why open source and open content are fundamental to learning networks. Learning networks won't work unless the software and the content are open. Very important. And now I'm going to go through these slides. I guess I forgot I had individual slides for each of those 3 points. But I have nice pictures. So you can look at the pictures. I want to linger on this too. And this is where I part company from some people who are working in learning and online learning. There's the perception that learning is something separate from everything else. I even got that from your presentation, Colin, a little bit from Graham's, where, you know, you would say, oh, I have some kind of learning objective. I'm going to go out and do this learning thing. You put everything else that you're doing down, and you go over here, now I'm going to do some learning. I'm learning now, and then I'm done learning. I'm going to go back to work or go back to my hobby or whatever. But in the learning network's picture that I propose, learning and living, learning and working, these are not separate things. And I'll talk about this in a little bit, but I'll presage it by saying, because the question came up, well, how do you know what thing to do next? How do you structure and organize the learning activities? And while I endorse the recommender system approach, the recommender system approach will depend on a context of activity, right? It's not just what thing should I use now, but what thing should I use now in order to do what I'm doing? And that's where you set up the learning goal. But most people don't sit down and say, oh, I have a learning goal. You know, teachers have learning goals. Students have, well, they just want to learn. They don't really know what the goal is necessarily, but they know what they want to do. And so, in order to get the recommendation in the context, the learning needs to happen in the context of some application. Work, play, hobby, whatever. When I was wandering around this morning looking for this place in the fog, the context was me trying to find it, but also the context was a car wash over by the highway, which is where I found myself. And I needed to know how to get here from there, as opposed to the hotel, which is where I started and then went the wrong way. Here's the picture. This is what came to me in a dream. That's a scary thought, isn't it? Actually, the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10... it was in color. It had 10 distinct stages. But this is basically the picture. And I've drawn it like this to try to emphasize that each of these, I've forgotten how many there are, 10, each of these 10 things are actually separate, standalone applications. Located in different places, there are multiple instances of any of them, and they communicate together. So this is not an application that I am describing with this diagram. This is a network. It's the definition of different types of entities or nodes in the network. And then some talk about how they connect together. At the top is the concept of the resource profile. And this is a way to think about how to describe learning resources. And it's touched on a bit in some other presentations, and again, Collins, but I want to draw this out and make this clear, so that we have a very clear idea, a very clear understanding in our mind of what our metadata looks like. And I'm not going to do squiggles and arrows and 37-page documents. I'm going to give you a little picture. That's how I think. Well, at least in my dream. That's as good. XML dreams? No. little pictures? Yes. There are three types of metadata. There are first-party metadata, second-party metadata, third-party metadata. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, think about how you know about a person. That's a person. The information you get about that person comes from a variety of sources. Right? Like, they did not rely simply on my CV to invite me here. They got, well, better information and to find out whether they should. And similarly, anytime you're trying to understand a person, you'll get information from the person, maybe, you know, I am Stephen Downs, that's first-party metadata. It's coming from the person, him or herself. But you might get information about the sorts of things that I do in society. Like, I have a credit card, for example, something that still surprises me, but I do. And as I use the credit card, that creates information, information created in the context of use, which is automatically collected, and then when I fail to pay my credit card bill, it shows up as part of my credit record. Or I have information about me that was generated by a third party, hence third party metadata, a certification authority. In this case, the Government of Canada, which certified that I am a Canadian citizen by issuing me with a passport. Our understanding or our information, our description of resources works in the same way. Consider a learning resource. First party metadata would be metadata created by the author of that resource. The title, the name of the author, the publication date, things like that. Second party metadata would be metadata created in the context of use of that resource. If somebody reads the resource, a little bit of metadata is generated. So-and-so read such-and-such in the context of, and then it's a class or whatever. And then third-party metadata is metadata that is evaluative or classification metadata. It's metadata created by third parties about the resource. So, two thumbs up, 4 out of 5, not recommended for under 16, whatever, any of those sorts of things. So you have three separate sets of metadata. So you need to think about that now. What we need in a learning network are mechanisms to fling not just the resources around, but all of this metadata around. Okay, getting the resources into the system. This is the resource production application. And the resource production application, we're already beginning to see a whole bunch of them, and we will see more. Some are proprietary, some are open source. We have Blogger, for example, which was one of the early resource producing tools that was really easy to use and easy to learn. And what was important about Blogger and similar pieces of software is that it produced not simply the web page, which was the blog, but it also produced XML. It produced metadata at the same time that it produced data. And so Blogger produces XML, which is later harvested. These other applications also have this in common. Flickr, for example, if you create your own photograph, upload your photograph, Flickr will produce metadata describing your photograph. Over on the lower right, and it's kind of hard to see because I shrunk it down, is an application out of Rice University called Connections. And Connections is a tool that instructors use in order to author learning resources. And Connections as well produces the data, and it produces the metadata. And then finally, in the lower left-hand corner, we have something that David Wiley was using in order to produce book reviews. And this uses a type of technology known as structured blogging. Now, what we are seeing in the blogging community and the resource community in general are more finely grained content authoring tools. So on one side, there's structured blogging, where you'll get detailed metadata about blog posts, or if you look up microformats.org, you'll see the same thing except expressed in XHTML. We need more of these. We need a variety of these. And this will be an important piece of the open source puzzle. The resource producing applications feed into resource repositories, and this is something that we've actually got down pretty well. We have already out there the Open Archives Initiative, DSpace, and I've put down Cordra, although I think that this initiative, which is coming out of Advanced Distributed Learning, that's the U.S. organization behind STORM and some such things, I think that that's actually taking it too far. The simplicity of things like Open Archives Initiative and DSpace create applications that anybody can use. They can be standalone applications. They do not need to belong to some sort of system. They can, if you have an OAI repository, you can register it with a site like Oyster, but you don't have to. The functionality is essentially the same across these repositories. The capacity to upload, and that's your resource producing tool, needs to be able to communicate with your repository tool. So if you are authoring a resource authoring tool or a resource producing tool, then you need mechanisms that allow you to take the content and upload it to DSpace, to OAI, but not just to them, also to your individual Flickr account, or your Blogger account, or any other content repository service on the internet. Once the materials are in the repository, there's two major streams that come out. On the one hand, the resources themselves, and on the other hand, the metadata about the resource. And it's the metadata that we're mostly interested in at the moment, and the major functionality of a repository is to provide for or allow the harvest. The harvest is the production of metadata in XML format, either RSS or Dublin Core, or even, if you really want to, learning object metadata. Optionally, and I'm a bit less in favor of these, a repository will produce a set, or it'll allow for search functionality. Now, the thing with repositories, people have different pictures of repositories, and there's two major pictures of repositories. On the one hand, there's what may be called the harvest-type repositories. On the other hand, there's federated or federations of repositories. And in the educational community, to my observation, is drifting toward the federated model. And the reason for that is they are able to manage the collection of repositories. They're able to control access to the repositories to create what you might call a trusted network. But now, this, in my opinion, breaks the openness criterion of the network. It needs to be the case that whoever wants to create a repository can do so. And it should be the case that whoever wants to access metadata from a repository can do so. The federated system, in my view, does not scale. It does not scale because it requires that the individual repositories all support that search capacity, which means that as your network gets larger, you've imposed more and more overhead on the individual repositories to support each and every search on the network. And that means that a federated repository system is going to be composed only of a few massive repositories. And it will not allow for the choice and the diversity that will make the network successful. So I am recommending many small open repositories where the repository itself does not try to handle the search function. All the repository does is provide the resource and the metadata about the resource, and then that metadata is harvested. Think more like your website, where you're not going to try to duplicate the function of Google because you couldn't do it. So what you do is you put your website up on the web, you let Google come along and harvest it, so the search will be done somewhere else. All you need to do is put the stuff up there. Now, Graham will probably bother me about this later. One of the things that I've run into quite a bit while working on learning networks is a need for a mechanism minimally of expressing rights. Now, you know, we're an open source crowd here. We see something like DRM and we sort of go, no, evil, evil. And we're right to do that. But even in the case of open resources, you need a mechanism to express the fact that this resource may be freely used. We already have seen this in the software community with things like the GPL. We would have a much harder time making open source software work without licenses like the GPL, which state this is open source software. And the same thing happens in the content world. We need mechanisms for saying that our content may be freely shared. ODRL is one such mechanism. Creative Commons is another such mechanism. So the idea here is that in a learning network, you embed or encode the type of rights model that your content conforms to in the metadata describing that content. And I actually did throw a little bit of XML up in the upper corner so that you can see it there, although I put it in light blue so it's hard to see. Well, if you're going to read XML, it might as well be a challenge. But the idea here is that when in the metadata describing the resource, you have a pointer to the metadata describing the rights associated with that resource. That metadata is what I call a rights model. And you have one model that applies to many resources. And if you think about it, that's exactly how Creative Commons does it. Creative Commons has a set of six models, and then if you want to declare a resource to conform with one of those rights models in your resource on your web page, you put a pointer to that rights model. And the same thing ought to, and indeed will happen, with respect to learning resource metadata. We've seen in Dublin Core and some of the discussions of Dublin Core and ODRL using that pointer mechanism. I flagged that because an alternative approach that's used in some quarters is to try to take all of the rights metadata and plug it into the resource metadata, and the rights metadata actually can double the size, triple the size of your resource metadata. And worse, once your metadata is out there in the world, you can't change the rights description. So, not so bad for open source people, but it's really hard for commercial people. If somebody wants to sell their resource, and they put it out there, $10 for this resource, and they sell exactly one copy, and they say, well, gee, maybe we better change the price. If the metadata is out there in the resource metadata, they can't do anything. But if they have a rights model that that resource points to, they just change the rights model, and that changes the property, the rights property of the resource. I don't want to linger too long on rights because I don't like them much. Resource aggregation is, in my view, the heart of the system. And what this part of the model does is it draws out a bit of what we've been talking about with respect to resource aggregation. Typically, the model that we have when we look at OAI, or we look at things like TechnoRaddy or PubSub or BlogDex or any of these aggregation services, is a mechanism that retrieves the metadata from the repository, and that's it. Well, it brings it all together and then you search that. But in fact, we want to think of resource aggregation as being more complex than that. We're bringing in not just the first party metadata created by the content creator, but our aggregator is also bringing in second and third party metadata from second and third party sources. Again, think of your aggregator is trying to understand a resource, is trying to learn about the resource. So it'll get information from the producer of the resource, but also from the users, also from evaluation agencies, also from governments, and it brings it together. So you get, you know, mighty metadata files, if you will. And you have much richer resource descriptions as a consequence. And you use those resource descriptions, or can use, should use, in order to sort, filter, and organize your resource presentation. Again, Colin talked about self-organizing systems and recommender systems. This is where the meat of that happens, is in the search, filter, and organize, where the information coming from multiple parties is used to cluster sometimes resources, is used to facilitate searches and the like. A resource repository, for example, or a resource aggregator, should allow you to search not simply on the subject or the content of the resource, but also, you know, pick only those resources that received a thumbs up from Stephen. I always write myself into these solutions. Or pick only resources that are available for free using a Creative Commons license. Or pick only resources that have previously been used in a Science 141 course at such and such a university. As the second and third party metadata aggregates through the lifetime of the resource, we're able to get more and more precise descriptions. I want to point out as well, this is a bit of a sub-box here, to indicate the structure of the network, because one of the things I've noticed is when I talk about these sorts of things, it sounds like I'm talking about some application. But you should notice there are many repositories, many small repositories, but there are also many resource aggregators, not just one. And the idea is that the resource aggregator can be a service provided by a company or a university, but it can also be something even... Is this a microphone? No, it's a light. Speak to the light. It can also... A resource aggregator can be something as simple as something that runs on your desktop. What we need and don't really have yet are good personal resource aggregators. Remember, we mentioned the personal VLE. This thing doesn't work without an aggregator. And the aggregator needs to pull in these multiple types of metadata. And so what happens is, if you have a resource aggregator, then you pick and you choose the resources that you are going to harvest from. right now, the Technorati, PubSub, etc., they harvest from everything. Google harvests, you know, over how many billion websites, which is why you get, you know, you type in something like arts in Google, you get like 8 million listings. Or, you know, if you type in natural law, you get some legal case in the United States. But if you can have aggregators which harvest only a subset of the available material, then the quality of your search improves substantially. I have a personal aggregator that I call EduRSS. EduRSS harvests only resources in educational technology. And the searches and the categorization from that are consequently much better because I'm not getting unrelated information from elsewhere in the field. Okay, 20 minutes. I love doing that. And sometimes I actually take it too, but I won't this time. He says. Now, here's the big difference between my presentation and the one that preceded. In the one that preceded, the student's personal learning environment was, and I believe these actual words were used, a content player. I don't believe in content players. Because if I have content in front of me, I want to mess with it. The whole point of a learning network is not just getting stuff in, but getting stuff in, messing around with it, mashing it up, repurposing it, filtering it, breaking it, folding it, spindling it, mutilating it, and sending it out as something new, because that's where the learning happens. So the common environment is not simply something that plays things for you. Now, it can do that. Here we have our common environment. This is just one interpretation of it, where on the left, there's the results coming in from our aggregator. We've done a search on the aggregator. It comes up. A smart learning environment will look at what you're typing and suggest things. Of course, we don't want it to be too insistent. Everybody remembers Clippy. And people will learn to hate that side. So we want it to be controllable. At the bottom, if they need to do a search or something like that, you have an interface to a search. And then in the center area there is not a viewer, it's an editing tool. Where the content that comes in such a way that you can start editing it and messing around with it. And bringing multiple things into the same environment. Now, at the beginning of the talk, it was kind of a ho-hum, yeah, we've all seen this before, I talked about the resource production side of things. This is resource production as well. This is the same as that other thing. I actually have two separate boxes for the same thing. But now, we have students using this, students bringing in resources, students creating resources. The whole idea of resources, of learning resources, as produced only by professors and publishers and people with the right qualifications, you don't need that in a recommender system. Students produce resources. These resources go back into the system. We have second and third party metadata. If these student produced resources are used, they will show up. If they are well evaluated, they will show up. So we have a way of picking the best of what the students produce. The students are in control, not just of consuming, not just of which resources they consume, but what they produce with them. It's a bit of a sidebar, but in order to make this work, you need a constant and consistent identity across the system. And so you need personal identity mechanisms. A few have been proposed. I've proposed one I call MIDM, and if you do a search for that, you'll find some demonstration software. OpenID was produced by the people at LiveJournal. It's very similar to MIDM. In fact, we were talking back and forth just before. And then SKIP is another type of system. SKIP depends on a central identity registry. OpenID and MIDM do not. And in my view, you want a non-registry-based identity system. And there are a variety of reasons for that. But essentially, it allows people to self-identify when they go to access a resource, and there's a relation between themselves and the resource, but there isn't some third party out there keeping tabs. So just like when you go to a store and buy a box of cereal, you don't report that to the government. Similarly, you shouldn't need to report to the government that you're accessing a resource, strictly between you and the resource provider. And the mechanism here is you create an identity, you have your own identity server on your own website, and when you go to a resource, you tell the resource the location of that server, and then an exchange follows between the server and the remote resource, where information about your identity based on your preferences is delivered to the external resource. That's a thumbnail version of a more complex phenomenon. But again, identity and a system like this is a natural for open source software. The commercial world has tried it, but they always put this whole layer of authentication on it, and consequently none of these systems have been picked up. The other thing which is a bit different is where these resources are used. Remember I talked about there not being a distinction between learning and living. We want these learning resources, we want this whole mashup, create your own resource capacity to be delivered everywhere. Not just in a computer, not just in a platform, but on your PDA, in your toaster. You should be able to program your toaster to send you toaster recipes if you want. I don't know what used they be, but and finally, as you, the student, bring things in, mash things up, create new resources, you too feed back into the system with content syndication into these resource aggregators, these resource repositories. All of this occurs in the context of community, where your personal identity and the syndicated content that you produce is fed into this community, and then your membership in this community becomes that much more metadata that is harvested by your resource aggregator. It becomes second and third party metadata. The fact that your friend used a resource becomes an important search parameter for you. It's like recommender systems, but it's recommender systems that are piggybacking on social networking functions. This doesn't exist yet, but it's going to. So the takeaway from this talk, Charles Vest talked about the meta-university, the way it looks like to the student. This is one big university. What I've just sketched here, and it's only a sketch to give you the lay of the land, is, if you will, the information architecture for the meta-university. Again, the key is not big systems. You know, people start coding in Java, I start nervously walking away because it means a big system. That's why I like scripting languages like Perl or whatever. But it doesn't matter what you code it in. What it means is small, flexible pieces of software anybody can install, because that's how you build the network. Imagine you had to go through a 3-day installation process by a technical professional in order to launch a web browser. Nobody would do it. And that's the level of adoption we need for this network to work. And this applies not only to resources, not only to applications, but to the metadata itself. Don't think learning object metadata. Think a little bit of metadata about the author, a little bit of metadata about the title, a little bit of metadata about where it was used, and you smoosh it all together. That's my talk. I thank you very much for your patience and for the invitation. Thank you very much.
stay for lunch. Okay.
Okay, then on the other half.